know what's what. But our plan is to conduct this as a master class where we do, as Bob said, make a few introductory remarks just to kind of prime the pump. And then, if Jim and I can somehow hold ourselves back, we're going to stop talking with plenty of time, as Bob has promised, for your reactions to what we've said, to your questions, and hopefully to your telling us what's on your mind, what the issues are that you think would be valuable to discuss in this enormous brain trust that we have in the room this afternoon. So without further ado, let me tell you what the students this morning were interested in hearing about, because Jim and I did this at the other hotel where the PRSSA is meeting today. And before we addressed that group, we asked their chapter advisor, Rich Toth and Elizabeth Toth, what the students at Maryland, for example, would be interested in hearing about. And they told us that the students wanted to know how a theory as ancient as the excellence theory could have relevance for today's practice of public relations. They've been studying a theory that traces its roots back to the 1960s, after all. And, you know, they weren't born until 1990, probably. So, you know, given the emerging social media, what is still important about the excellence study? My answer to them was a pretty short answer. I think there are three explanations, and then Jim, in his usual fashion, will elaborate on that. But I would begin by saying that theory is not static. Something that is conceptualized years ago is going to change over time, because for one thing, we continue to do research on the theory. We do, our colleagues do, our former students do, people working in the field of public relations continue to investigate. And with more data and more analysis, we are able to refine the theory. So what we theorized in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and into the 1990s looks very different from the excellence study as it exists today. And that's partly, of course, because we do continue to do the empirical work. But also it's because the world is changing. And with things like globalization and the crises that we've experienced so visibly in the last few years, and of course the emerging digital media, all of these factors would undoubtedly influence whatever theory is useful to our field. So we've taken those things, globalization, crises, and the social media into account. And you'll hear about some of the impacts of those factors today. We also have discovered on this long journey of investigation that relationships are even more central to excellence in public relations than we might have acknowledged when that project began in 1985. Relationships are what make public relations excellent. That's the main contribution that we make to the organization. But today, rather than years back, we now know how to measure relationships, thanks to the work of scholars like Dr. Flora Hung, who's with us today from Hong Kong. We know exactly how to measure the qualities of a relationship, and especially how to distinguish one type of relationship from another. So we know, for example, that if you want to have a good relationship with your stakeholders, you need to, first of all, have trust between the two parties. There must be commitment, a sense of loyalty to the relationship, that we're all in this for the long haul. There has to be satisfaction with the relationship. And satisfaction may sound like a squishy term, but what we mean by satisfaction and the way we measure it is to ask people whether they believe that they're getting enough out of the relationship to continue putting something into the relationship. Is the return on your investment in the relationship, in other words, adequate? And then finally, and I think the most important of the four main qualities of a relationship, is what's called control mutuality, or the possibility that both parties in the relationship have an influence on that relationship. It doesn't have to be a 50-50 deal. So if you're talking about the relationship, for example, between employees and the management of the organization, we're not insisting that, say, factory workers have an equal say in the running of the company. But we are saying that people who work in an assembly line know about their job. They are the experts in what they do, and so certainly they should have some control over their work. And if you think about your personal relationships, I'm sure you can see that mutuality of control is very important in personal relationships as well as in work relationships. Who wants to be married to a bully, for example? Who wants to have to go to every restaurant that the partner picks? So the idea is that in a good quality relationship, there's give and take, and there's mutually possible influence there. And then based on these four qualities, we can also determine whether the relationship is one of exchange, a tit for tat kind of relationship. If you do this for me, I'll do that for you. If you come to my lecture, I'll go to yours next time. That's an exchange relationship. What we are more about in public relations, I think, and this is something that the students wanted to talk about this morning, we're more about communal relationships. In other words, we do what we think is in the interest of the relationship more than the self-interest of the organization that employs us. And this is, again, I think what people do in their loving family relationships. They don't expect to get back something for everything they give because they know that in the long term, this kind of selfless relationship is going to pay big dividends, and anyway, it's the right thing to do. So we know how to characterize relationships, and that's a really important thing because that is the essence, of course, of public relations. Now, the new media that we have today make it more possible than ever before to achieve our goals in terms of relationships with stakeholders. Well, all of the principles of the excellence theory that Jim is going to talk about in just a minute. Because of the interactive nature of the social media, of the digital media, it makes it more possible than it was in the 60s or 70s or 80s or 90s or even in 2000 to have a kind of two-way balanced dialogue with publics. You know, before that, we always talked about the importance of symmetrical balanced communication. But try finding organizations that did this successfully. There were some, so we knew that the concept actually existed. It wasn't some kind of pie in the sky stuff. But on the other hand, it was really hard for organizations to find a way to let their stakeholders initiate communication. Otherwise, you know, the typical thing was sending out a message and then waiting for feedback. But feedback is not true two-way dialogue. Either party in the relationship should be able to initiate the conversation. And organizations needed to find better ways to listen to their stakeholders than they had done in the past. So now with things like blogs and Facebook, we can do that. We can be on the listening end. And our publics can be those who initiate communication with us. And then we factor all of that intelligence into organizational decision making. So we have this possibility for social engagement, and we can measure that too. We can measure, as Minjung Kang has done at Syracuse University, the credibility, say, of blogs. These are not things that we knew about or knew how to evaluate even a few years ago. So the field has come a long way, and I would like to think that our theorizing has moved right along with it. And Jim now will tell you a little bit more about the excellence theory that I've been just kind of hinting at here. And when he's done with that, we look forward to hearing from all of you.
Well, let me reiterate what Lori said and say that it's really a pleasure to see so many old friends and former students and colleagues and other acquaintances from many years. It's really a pleasure to see you all here. You may be coming to hear us say something new, and I keep thinking, well, do I know anything that I didn't know a long time ago? But as Lori said, I think the principles that we knew a number of years ago are still relevant today, and in fact, some of the changes that have taken place in recent years have made them more relevant than ever before. The session was set up around the excellence theories, and I may mention, say that there are several theories included in the excellence principles. Originally, Bob Grubb had written a description that talked about this just being about the symmetrical model. And I thought, well, that's I'm tired of talking about that and arguing about it. And that's, besides, that's what too many people think is the only element of the excellence theory. So let's point out what some of the others are. So then I redrafted the program description and included 8 principles of excellence, but then as the program was edited, my 8 principles got taken out. So now I can tell you briefly what they are and how they're relevant today. Let me say first that I think that Lori and I have been fortunate, and probably me especially, because I'm slightly older than she is, to have come into by only 4 years, so it's not all that much, to have come into the practice or the teaching of public relations at the time when there was very little theory available. This morning I told the students about when I first came to the University of Maryland. I had only taken one course in public relations, and this was a course I had audited from Scott Cutler in the PhD program. When it was an undergraduate course, and I was in the PhD program, and I audited that, so I'd know something about public relations. I had practiced public relations and internships and part-time work at Iowa State University and at various other places, but I had never formally studied public relations. And I learned a few of the basic theories from Scott Cutler that I think are still with us today. So, for example, in 1952 he wrote in Effective Public Relations that public relations is a management function. It's not just a messaging or communication function. And he also pointed out, he had a long chapter on the environment of organizations and how public relations helps the organization interact with the environment. So I think, and he also talked a great deal about two-way communication. I don't know how many of you ever knew Scott Cutler, but he was quite vociferous and demonstrative, let us say. And in the first day of class, he had a long blackboard, and he wrote on one side of the board one way, and then he went to the other side and wrote one way, and then he put an arrow between it and said, public relations is two-way communication. And that was kind of a revelation to me, and it's where I think the idea for the two-way symmetrical theory eventually came from. But we were able to actually begin to develop theories when there weren't any others around. For example, I worked on a situational theory of publics beginning in actually the 1960s. We developed models of public relations. Our colleague David Dozier developed roles, a series of roles in public relations. Another colleague, Bill Ayling, was talking about doing research and doing measurement and evaluation and environmental scanning and so on. But when we got together as a team, we put all of our various ideas and most of the theories that I think were important at the time into the Excellence Project, or the theories that we studied. So we started that project with a simple question from the IEBC Research Foundation, which essentially was, how do you show the value, or what is the value? Can you articulate the value of public relations to an organization? And then we added the question to that, okay, well, if we do that, then we have to realize that not all public relations adds value. Some of it actually is quite worthless. And so we have to have some principles of what kind of public relations is going to add the most value to the organization. Well, we concluded that the value of public relations, as Lori has said, comes through relationships, that public relations helps organizations develop stakeholders with relationships with its stakeholders. Later, we added the idea that this is an intangible asset that has value for accounting purposes to the organization, but that the essence of value of public relations comes through relationships. Well, what is the best way for organizations to cultivate and develop relationships with their organizations, with their stakeholders, with their publics? And here we came up with what now I say are 8 principles. If you've read all this, don't get confused, because at one point there were 10 and another time there were 12. But we keep consolidating. But Like Scott Cutliff, we said that first public relations to be excellent needs to be managerial. It has to have a managerial role in the organization as well as a technical kind of messaging or journalistic role. And this came from Dozier and Broom's research on roles in public relations. Second, we learned both from our colleague John White from the UK and then through the excellent study itself, is that that public relations needed to not only be a managerial function, but also a strategic managerial function. That is, you needed someone to go beyond budgeting and hiring and firing, but also to take part in the strategic decision making of the organization. And this turned out to be the most important finding of the excellence study, not actually the symmetrical model, but the strategic role of public relations. And recently I've been writing and speaking a lot about a strategic management role for public relations as opposed to a traditional symbolic interpretive role of public relations. Well, in addition to being strategic, we said that public relations needed to be integrated. And I think this probably mostly came from Bill Ayling, who was fighting the IMC, integrated marketing communication idea at the time, that public relations should be integrated into the marketing function. We concluded that public relations should be integrated, but not into the marketing function, and that perhaps integrated marketing communication should be integrated into public relations. So the basic idea is that organizations should have a single coordinated function to communicate with all of the publics of the organization. Well, the fourth principle was the symmetrical principle, which came out of the models of public relations. The idea was a very simple one, that organizations needed to be concerned about the welfare and the interests of their stakeholders as well as the organization's interests itself. This whole idea has sparked a lot of controversy, and we'll be happy to talk more about it, but it seems to me at this point almost axiomatic that organizations, given the kinds of crises that they faced in recent years, have little choice other than to be symmetrical and to be managed for the interest of all of the stakeholders and not just the management and the stockholders. The fifth principle is that that public relations needs to promote social responsibility or sustainability of the organization. And this would provide value to society and value for the profession of public relations as well as value to the organization itself. The next principle was diversity. And this largely came from the sole female member of our research team, whose name I don't need to mention, but she pointed out that there's an emerging majority of women in public relations, and we needed to be concerned about the role of women in public relations and of other forms of diversity, so that as one of the people I interviewed in the Excellence Project told me, it was actually a vice president of strategic management at a chemical company. He said, and I quote, if every member of every public of an organization was a white male who went to an Ivy League school, then we wouldn't need to have diversity in the public relations function. So this became also a very important part of the Excellence Principles. Well, after we finished the project, the first thing we did was try to extend this to a global basis. And we did this in collaboration with some colleagues in Slovenia, in particular Dejan Verčić, who is a good friend of ours. But we spent almost a month in Slovenia one summer after finishing the Excellence Project. And we tested the principles by going through intense interviews with our colleagues there and saying, do these principles apply in Slovenia? And if so, should they be adjusted and adapted? And have we left anything out? And the first thing they suggested was the principle of ethics or ethical practice. And so after the study, we added the notion that public relations has to have an ethical role in the organization. not just that public relations itself should be ethical, but that it should be an ethics counselor, an ethical supporter in the organization itself, or a champion of ethics in decision making. And then finally, today we would say excellent public relations is global. And this came from our work in many different countries and many different locations. As a global function, the question always becomes, are the principles the same in different kinds of countries, in different kinds of societies and cultures? And thanks to our former student, Rob Wakefield, who's sitting in the front row, we came up with a theory of generic principles and specific applications. That the principles at an abstract level are generic to different societies and cultures, but in actual application, they have to be applied differently in different settings. So this provides a good way for being able to understand how, say, a multinational corporation should manage its public relations function, or how a multinational public relations firm should organize in different countries. In each case, they need to have a common set of principles that can come from throughout the world or be integrated into their worldview of what public relations is, but then they have to have people familiar with the local context to be able to apply them. Well, those are the principles. Now the question is, have things changed now so that they're no longer relevant or more or less relevant? And I think back to a year ago when I gave a presentation to a group like this in Norway. And they asked me to give a presentation on, quote, can an established approach to public relations still work in today's world, or something like that. And I stopped for a long time and said, well, I don't think it's really established yet, because I see many examples of practice that haven't followed the excellence principles. And so I wouldn't quite consider it old hat or established. Then I pointed out is that the changes that have occurred in recent years actually have made the excellence principles more relevant and made it more feasible to practice them, and I think may make them even more important than before. And the two biggest changes are, I think, the kinds of social responsibility crises that organizations have faced in the last 20 years, but in particularly in the United States, at least in the last 3 years. And the other is the growth of the digital media, which many practitioners say have completely changed the nature of public relations. And I'd say something first about the nature of global crises and so on. And in here I include the financial crisis, the internet bubble of the 1990s, the bank scandals before that, the recent BP oil spill, and so on. All of these crises have led to a great deal of discussion about sustainability of organizations. And sustainability has become a new concept that has incorporated what we used to call CSR, corporate social responsibility, or corporate responsibility, and so on. The question is, how can organizations anticipate and deal with not just crises, but with problems that they encounter in their relationships with such society so that they become more sustainable? And I think it's here where it's extremely important that public relations be a strategic management function. That is a function that not only communicates decisions made by others in the organization, but participates in that decision making itself. And someone in the organization needs to be able to anticipate the risk of different decisions before they are made. Because if there's too much risk taken in these decisions, it's going to make it the organization unsustainable over the long term. And it's also going to create a lot of damage for stakeholders, for publics themselves. And I think sometimes what organizations typically do if they have a new problem, like when the environment became a problem, 35 years ago or something like that, many created new departments of environmental communication. Or when issues management first came into the vocabulary, probably in the 1970s, they created separate issues management departments. And today, many seem to be creating separate sustainability departments. But I can't think of a better place to put sustainability and corporate social responsibility, or responsibility for responsibility, if you will, than in the public relations function. But to be able to do that, public relations people have to change, or at least begin to think of what they do more as strategic counseling, of environmental scanning, of issues management, and so on, and less about strictly dealing with the media and media relations and being able to pitch and place news stories in the media. So I think that the excellence principles, if you follow them through and implement them in organizing a public relations function, you will have a department that is much more able to help an organization deal with problems, with risks to stakeholders, with crises, and so on. The second thing I would mention is the new media. And statistics show that at least half of public relations departments in the U.S. today are responsible for digital communications, for blogging, for networking, for microblogging, and so on. So it's becoming extremely important in public relations. At the same time, I hear practitioners saying, you know, everything's changed now. We've lost control over the message. People can say whatever they want about us. And as though they ever could control the message that publics receive. I mean, if we go back to my own situational theory of publics that I developed in the late 1960s, basically that theory said that people are responsible for their own communication behavior. They seek out information that's relevant to problems that they face. Followed the logic of John Dewey in the 1920s, who said people do not think unless they experience a problem, and when they experience a problem, they begin to inquire, in other words, seek information. So I think that the idea that one could ever control the messages going to publics was always an illusion. In fact, I've written recently an article that's called The Illusion of Control. First, I pointed out that we never could control the information going to publics. We never could define who the publics are, and we usually couldn't persuade them to do what the organization wanted them to do. But now with the new media, all of that control is even more of an illusion. Because today, members of publics are not constrained by what the media choose to put in, provide to them. Publics can create their own content, they can go to each other, they can interact with publics, members of the same publics from throughout the world, they can create rumors, they can create crises, and so on. So publics are in control, and as Richard Edelman said in the first Grunig lecture 2 years ago, public relations people can now participate in the conversation. So it's not so much a matter of controlling information going to publics, but participating in the conversations that are taking place around organizations and in organizations and about organizations. So that, and then I think what we need to recognize about new media, and I will just say a word here and then open this up so you can participate in the conversation, is that typically whenever there's a new medium, practitioners tend to use the new medium the way they use the old medium. So supposedly when television was first invented, all the TV stations did was have people sit in front of a camera and read the news as though they were still on radio. They took a long time before they learned to use pictures and so on. I think with the new media, what practitioners tend to do too much is just dump information into the new media, or think of them as a means of publicity or promotion or sales and so on, or simply as a way of carrying out communication programs. We know we can do employee relations and media relations and investor relations and perhaps even government relations through the internet and through new media, and we can do them more effectively than before. But I think what we tend to forget is that if public relations is indeed a two-way a street. It's a two-way process. We can also use the new media to do research and to bring information into the organization that we couldn't otherwise do. And this makes the strategic management function easier than it would be before, because we can follow what people are saying about us on the organization. We can identify the problems that they experience with the organization or that they would like the organization to deal with. We can determine when they form into publics and begin to talk to each other, and we can identify the issues they create and the kinds of crises that they're going to. So we can do this much more effectively with new media than we could with traditional media, because in the past, issues, by the time something got into the media, it was too late to deal with an issue. It was almost always a crisis. Now we can identify it when people are first beginning to talk about it on the internet in one way or another. But I think as we go through the strategic management process, I think that we can identify the publics on the internet. We can identify the kinds of issues they create. We obviously have to deal with crises when they occur on the internet. I think we can measure relationships. I haven't figured out quite how to do this yet, but I think we can take characteristics of relationships we've identified and develop content analysis schemes so that we can identify publics and try to analyze our relationships with them in the new media. I think we can measure reputations. David Phillips, who has written recently a book on digital public relations, said, and I quote him often, that reputation is what you get when you Google your organization or yourself on the internet. And as I define reputation, it's what people think and say about you, and there's no better place to find it than on the internet. So I'm going to stop at this point. We've thrown out a number of ideas. We still have about 35 minutes for dialogue, and I'll sit down and we'll open the floor to you, and there may be other things you want to ask us about, or you may want to debate or discuss with us, but we'll turn it over to you at this point.
As Jim suggests, we'd like to open up to a conversation. I'd simply ask, please stand and speak up and identify yourself and or your organization with comments or questions for Jim or Lori. Go ahead.
Jim, Lori, a lot of organizations that do not approve of necessarily are using techniques that are, you might call, propaganda. Organizations that are being harmed, terrorist organizations, others, in more parts of the world. And I wonder how you would respond to the extraordinary sophistication of these organizations that mean harm, that are not focused on the excellence principles, but use the techniques and the strategies inbound and outbound in the presentation of public relations.
Well, by harm, do you mean by harm by organizations, or they think they're being harmed in some way? Oh, they're doing harm. Okay. Well, they ought to be responsible also, I suppose, is the first place I would start. But it's always been a question of how do you define public relations and how do you classify different types of public relations. And that's always been, I think, the goal of concepts that I've developed, like the models of public relations, which actually was four models of public relations were preceded by another concept that I call diachronic and synchronic communication, meaning essentially the same thing as symmetrical and asymmetrical. But recently I've also been talking about the difference between a purely symbolic interpretive function, which is looks at public relations strictly as a kind of messaging activity whose goal it is to change the way people interpret the behavior of the organization or the way they interpret the problems that they're developing and so on. I think there's always a symbolic element to public relations, but if we divorce this communication, the symbolic aspect of it, from the behavior of the organization, I think we get into the position of being someone who's invited to put up a smokescreen around irresponsible behavior of the organization and trying to make it look better and so on. Now, although critical scholars would never claim that I'm a critical scholar, I believe that I am. And so I've always looked at criticizing this type of public relations. It's one thing to describe what the organizations are doing and analyzing what they're doing and even determining whether it's effective or not. And another thing to advocate that what they're doing ought to be copied by others or taught to students or be put up as a kind of professional standard. So, on the one hand, it's quite clear that terrorist organizations use public relations, but I think what they're using are strictly the kind of interpretive parts of public relations, trying to convince people that their cause is just or that they're right and so on, without also thinking about their own behavior and the consequences of their behavior on others. So I think I see no reason why activist groups, and I believe most activist groups actually are responsible. There are the extremes that aren't, but then we have extremes in corporations and governments and others. That I do believe it's important that those kind of the same kind of principles can be applied to activist groups as to others. Now, Lori's the expert on activism, so I assume she would like to do more.
Well, if you know us, you know that we always like to both answer every question because we can't stand it, you know. We're thinking, how would I answer that? So I'll just really quickly say that those groups, of course, have always been with us on this planet. That's nothing new, although the communication tools and techniques are new. The thing is, when Jim said these groups believe that their cause is just, that's the thing, you know, from whose perspective are they being evil? And if you look back at the history of public relations, some of our early campaigns were very well intentioned. For example, the campaign designed to liberate women from their oppressive husbands by allowing them to smoke on the street. Well, now we know that smoking is maybe more dangerous than the oppressive husband that occasionally. Well, enough said. Frank?
I'm Frank Oviatt. I have a question that Laurie can answer first. I'm going back to your third principle, the integration. And you said you were happier to see public relations integrated, or I'm sorry, marketing integrated than public relations than the other way around. Now, by now, we have enough chief marketing officers with both responsibilities, maybe 25% of the corporations, that if you accept the background of the chief marketing officer as a surrogate for who was integrated into who, you've got some that came from a public relations background and some that did not. Is there any research that says those organizations performed more excellent? Or is there other evidence available that in fact says you're better off to move marketing into public relations than public relations into marketing?
Are they being called a chief marketing officer or a chief communication officer?
John Watt is a great example. He's being called chief marketing officer. A lot of them are being called that.
From what I guess I'm the one who's researched this more than Lori, so I'll take the male role here. And I see Kirk Hallahan back here waiting for an argument. So I think what I think I've seen, maybe you see it differently in the Arthur Page Society, for example, is that you have a chief communication officer And increasingly, their response, they typically come from a public relations background rather than a marketing background. And they're responsible for marketing communication, at least, as well as for public relations. That may not always be the case, but there is a lot of evidence that when public relations reports to the marketing function, this was in the excellent study, and it's regularly in the studies at the University of Southern California Strategic Communications Center, that when public relations reports to marketing, that it typically has less respect from the C-suite than when it reports directly to the C-suite itself. Because then typically it becomes a marketing support function alone, rather than an integrated communication function that deals with all of the stakeholders. Now, so there are many organizations where public relations is responsible for marketing communication, even buying advertising and so on. It's less likely to be true in organizations that are marketing oriented, such as consumer product companies, where then they begin public relations becomes a marketing function rather than the other way around. Now, I like to think there's a difference in marketing theory and public relations theory, and I prefer public relations theory to marketing theory, because I think if you take many of the principles, it's more likely to be symmetrical, although there is discussion in marketing circles as well about, I think Kotler has a discussion of bilateral communication in his marketing textbook, but then when you get to his communication channel chapter, it's all about persuasion and advocacy and so on. So I think what's important, and we did find examples actually in the excellent study where public relations reported to marketing and it did quite well. What's really important is the understanding of the public relations function that whoever public relations reports to has. And that is, are they thinking it strictly as a marketing support messaging function where what public relations does is essentially only media relations, it's placing stories in the media, its measurement is all about media monitoring and so on, and not public relations as being someone who researches publics, who understands publics, who provides information, provides publics a voice in management and so on. I think you're more likely to get that point of view with someone who has public relations training and background.
I think rather than speaking to that myself, I will ask Kirk. I think I saw your hand up a minute ago. Did you have a comment here? Oh, okay. Anything else on this issue?
I'll draw the idea that you have to define what marketing is.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing about marketing is that at least people I know in the profession keep telling me that in most corporations it's just advertising. And I say, well, what about the other P's that they teach in marketing departments? You know, like developing products and placement and delivery and all of that sort of thing. And they say that that's not being done by marketing departments. That surprises me, but those of you who know more about marketing can tell me whether that's true or not. But I think as a strategic management function, I think public relations contributes something different than what marketing does. And that difference is relationships. Now, I know that relationship marketing is important, and I think public relations is always going to be involved in marketing, so I think we ought to bring a public relations perspective to that. Let's think about developing relationships with customers and less so about getting free advertising through publicity. Yeah. Did you want to go on, Kirk? Okay, and there's one here and then the question in the back.
In relationship to your theory, I'm listening to Central Washington University professors. In your opinion, through all of the crises and the huge multitude of crises that we have seen, especially in the last 5 years, some natural disasters, obviously some not, what is your opinion on how your model of public relations occurs? Because ideally we've got this two-way symmetrical communication model, but yet during many crises, modes of communication fail, such as in Hurricane Katrina. What is your opinion about modes of communication in that direction?
Well, my opinion would be that this illustrates, your point illustrates so beautifully the importance of relationships, because what makes communication work in times of crisis, when it rarely does, but when it works, it's because the relationships are in place ahead of time. Relationships are kind of like loyalty that's being banked for when it's most needed. Because a public, a stakeholder group that you have a good relationship with, remember, one of the qualities is commitment of a good relationship. If the stakeholder group is committed to the organization and vice versa, that public is likely to cut you a little slack when the crisis hits, even if the crisis is a human-made one rather than a natural disaster. They will give you time to get your side of the story out, and you will have established ways in which you can communicate. You know how to reach those people. They know how to reach you. So working on relationships before you really even need them is central to the work of an effective public relations person, I think, so that you have the time and the resources to develop good quality relationships that then provide what economists call a lumpy return. You don't get a constant return on your investment in public relations, but when a crisis hits, a good relationship can actually sustain or save the organization, so it's a huge payoff at that point.
What's common about all of these disasters of recent years is the fact that public relations either wasn't involved or didn't do a very good job. I wonder how many more there would, you know, what we have lots of examples of are irresponsible behaviors that lead to issues and crises, and then we can look back and say, well, where was public relations and it wasn't involved. What we have less of, actually, are examples and cases of organizations where public relations was involved in decision-making and management made better decisions so that an issue in a crisis didn't occur. Frank Oviatt had a discussion group 2 years ago with the European members of the Institute's board, and what they were saying is what we really desperately need are, if you will, case histories of successful cases when public relations has been involved and an issue was dealt with effectively. And I think that's too few organizations have institutional memories. The PR people come and go and they don't keep track of what worked and what didn't work. They don't write their own case histories. And you'd be surprised at how many organizations you can go in 5 years after they were one of the best and nobody knows what was done before because it's turned over. And I think I've written recently a lot about the need to institutionalize public relations as a strategic management function. By that I mean, how do we get people to think that's what public relations is rather than strictly an interpretive function? How do we institutionalize that so that when parents of our students hear that their daughter is going to study public relations, they don't say, you want to make your career out of taking advantage of people, or something like that. Or as I've just read in a book on stakeholder theory, it's written by two business school scholars in the UK. And they talk all about different theories of stakeholders, and then toward the back of the book they get into programs to work with stakeholders. And they say, among other things, unfortunately, it's too often this function is turned over to the public relations department. And where all you get is, you know, kind of superficial programs to make the organization look good and so on, and then they don't really have an idea about who should be doing this. So how do we get business scholars, how do we get journalists, how do we get parents, how do we get the public in general to think we're a good thing for society rather than a bad thing? And I think we have to develop these kinds of case histories. Okay. I also wanted to just mention the concept of risk for a minute, because I think I've been reading recently some papers from the Coe Roundtable, which is an organization in Minneapolis, headquartered in Minneapolis, that advocates corporate social responsibility. And in a recent position paper, the organization pointed out that both the Gulf oil crisis, the BP crisis, and the financial crisis occurred because organizations took too much risk for stakeholders, not necessarily for the organization, although the two are related. And I think as public relations people, we have to be able to assess the risk of different kinds of decisions, whether it be decisions to cut the corners in cutting costs in drilling in the Gulf, or risk in offering financial products. We don't have the expertise to do that all ourselves, but we can organize teams, we can organize advisors from throughout the organization so that it provides a kind of risk assessment. And I think relationships are important because they reduce risks for organizations when they make decisions, and I think it also reduces the risk for stakeholders.
Yeah, just go back to Jim's point about institutionalization for a moment. I want to clarify that we're talking about institutionalizing the function of public relations as a strategic and managerial function. We're not talking about calcifying the practice of public relations. We believe it's important for our field to grow and develop and be responsive to changes in the environment. And then the second thing, when Jim mentions risk in decisions, I was thinking about a clear-cut, not a case history, but anecdote related to the difference between integrated marketing communication and public relations that we got in the course of our interviews for the Excellence Project. It's just a really quick thing that to me captures one essential difference. One of the people we interviewed was talking about a marketing decision in his company to put a gas station on a particular corner at an intersection where there wasn't a service station existing at that time. And he said, you know, this made really good sense from a marketing perspective because here was an underserved market. But then he said, from our public relations perspective, it was a very poor decision because we knew the community. We have a strong community relations program there, and we know that children will be walking past that intersection on their way to school and on their way home from school, and the Quick Mart or whatever the fast food place was that was attached to the chain of gas stations would be something that kids would be tempted to stop in every day after school, and their parents would not appreciate this. So he said, we had to let the CEO make this decision. We made our best case in public relations. The marketing people made their best case. And fortunately, he said, the decision came down on the side of community. We didn't want to risk children being hurt by being hit by a car in the gas station as they crossed the parking lot. We didn't want them eating junk food and so forth. So, but, you know, things that make perfect sense from that marketing perspective may look very different when you take a public relations look at it.
There's a question in there.
Hi, I'm Richard Lipke, Chair of PRSA's tech section, and in my spare time, I'm with Lowe's Paul Partners, the division of Fletch & Hiller. And my question, Laurie, is to you. It's encouraging to hear that CSR should reside in the PR function, but as many of us have experienced with our companies or clients, CSR will originate with HR or other departments in a company, and they get dumped on PR. So I wonder what your thoughts are with how we can illustrate that CSR should reside as part of the PR department.
Well, I think the research shows right now that it typically does reside in public relations. And we think that's appropriate because we take a very broad look at all of our publics, our stakeholders. And here's where the case studies really become important. Not so much to show what CSR can do for you, but to show the worst case scenario. Here's what's going to happen to you if we are irresponsible, if we allow too much, you know, risk to our stakeholders. So having the negative examples is especially appropriate when you're talking about CSR and where it should be positioned.
You have to convince clients that CSR is different from philanthropy and that it's not a way to get publicity. I don't know what your clients want, but when you say, you know, it's often used in this kind of symbolic interpretive approach, you know, the company does something irresponsible, so then the question is, can we give money to some charitable cause and then get favorable publicity so it makes us look better? For the last 3 years, I've been judging a contest of the Public Relations Awards in Romania, which are like PRSA's awards, and they have one category in corporate social responsibility. And I've been given these. I look at 20 of them each year. And almost every one of them are sort of the same thing public relations people always do, but with some CSR project thrown in as a publicity gimmick to be able to get coverage and so on. One time we were in Australia and we were told by someone in a PR firm that they had a client. Well, there are several Australian entrepreneurs who do irresponsible things. So after they were caught doing something irresponsible, the question was, how much do we have to give to charity to cover this up? So I think when you start talking about the term sustainability today, I think you begin to think about the long-term sustainability of the organization as well as society. And then we say, well, what do we have to do to make that organization sustainable? There has been some arguments. Actually, I was going to mention, you probably know, but the Stockholm Accords that were agreed upon in Stockholm. In Oslo. I'm sorry. The Stockholm Accords agreed to in June includes sustainability as one of the primary activities of the Public Relations Department. And it says that public relations should both identify sustainability and encourage the organization to do it, as well as make sustainability reports and all of those sorts of things. So, I'm not sure how you convince the client or even management that public relations is the appropriate place to put it, but I think the starting point is to develop a kind of expertise to be able to do it, because there is a question. Benno Signitzer of Austria published an article in the Journal of Public Relations Research, I think 2 years ago, on what he calls corporate sustainability communication programs. And one of the questions asked was, do public relations people have the ability to do this? Now, my stakeholder people would say they don't. And I think many of your clients would probably think you don't have the ability, and so on. So you have to first develop the ability to be able to do this, the knowledge, the expertise, and so on. It's not something that will come from divine inspiration. You have to understand environmental issues. You have to understand social issues, and so on. And that, you know, many journalists who come into public relations understand that quite well. Others don't. It just, you know, that's a crucial characteristic, is to develop the kind of ability to sense when something is irresponsible and what its consequences are going to be and what kind of scenario might follow if management makes a decision that's irresponsible.
And of course, keeping in mind alignment all the time, that word seems to resonate with clients, talking about doing programs that are aligned with the interests of the client. You know, it doesn't make any sense for an auto manufacturer to build playgrounds for inner city school children, which has actually been done a lot. But that's not, building those playgrounds is a nice thing to do. It's a philanthropic activity. It's not really sustainability in the sense that we're talking about it. So something aligned with the interests of the car maker would make better sense, and it wouldn't necessarily be done just for publicity. You know, when the automakers did that, built those playgrounds, they called the camera crews in at great expense and tried to publicize this, which then had a negative backlash, of course. And you know from your own background, I'm sure, with media relations, that when you do publicity like that, there is the tendency of the traditionally trained journalist to look under the halo for the dandruff. So it isn't always a good thing to get publicity for philanthropic efforts. What are they doing this for?
Okay, Kirk.
Kirk Allingham, I want to follow up the idea on social media and its potential for excellence theory. Because I think one of the criticisms of excellence theory is it's always been channel agnostic in terms of not really being specific to any kind of form of communication, other than obviously dialogue and interpersonal communication support. Now we have this new great tool, a tool when you think about blogs and tweets and all of this, that it's very labor-intensive, which many clients still do not understand how labor-intensive it is. And you hire 23-year-old people who are very good at all the technology, who may not be very savvy or very well-positioned to speak on behalf of the company or the organization. And you get these volumes and get these volumes and volumes of input, you know, tweets back and blog postings and comments on blogs. The challenge, it seems to me, this is where I can get your thoughts, and I just gave my early comment about picking a fight, because that's not Jim and I have been in a fight before. The question is, how do we upstream all of this? How do we take advantage of it? How do we translate it into policy and get the serious attention of management about things that are going on in the media? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, in general, not just, you know, where there's the big explosion, which everybody can cover, but, I mean, when we talk about listening and we talk about paying attention to audiences and what's being said, you know, in cyberspace about us, how do we really upstream that and translate that into really meaningful policy? Because I think otherwise, if we really think that we're talking to people and we're listening and we're responding, mm-hmm. but we don't do anything with it, we're engaging in a huge fraud. We're deceiving ourselves, but we're also deceiving the public. And so I think that's one of the interesting challenges. I'd like to hear what your thoughts might be about how do we take this great opportunity that we now have and leverage it, use it, incorporate it in you know, being really excellent organization. And there may be other people who have thoughts about it.
Yeah, there may be people with a lot of experience on this, but as you mentioned, nothing against 22-year-olds who know how to Twitter and everything. I don't know if we have any 22-year-olds here. But the worst thing you can do is create a separate social media department that's just out there to serve, you know, it's kind of a superficial kind of way of interacting with the public and divorce it from your whole public relations activity. Now, what I think what ought to be done is you need... I'm not sure at what level you need people engaging with social media every day, and it also depends also on the size of your organization and the impact that it has on its publics. I just heard someone from a research company last week at the Measurement Summit saying that it's a company that's doing monitoring of the internet and automated and other kinds of monitoring to see who's saying what and what the messages are and so on. That about half of their clients don't get very much attention at all, and the other half get a great deal of them. But what I'm saying is there's all that information out there, and you have to systematically look at it and take advantage of it. And that's got to be information that's fed into the strategic management role. So you're going to need some fairly high-level people looking at what's on the internet, whether they're the ones that are sitting there every day and doing a Google search and looking for what people are saying. But I think the way to do this is to develop or institutionalize a research component in your public relations function. Because ultimately monitoring the internet and so on is a research function. And being able to look at what's being said and analyze it and classify it and identify issues and identify publics and so on is all a research issue.
It's also a relationship issue, though, as Kurt started his comment on. It's both. You know, it's bonding, if you will, and it's doing research. And it is a fraud to take a salary for work that you do monitoring the internet and then not using that information for action. I mean, that's why we're doing it, so that we not only have the intelligence, but we can make something of it. And I'd like to make a plug for the Institute's annual measurement summit, because these issues are discussed, have been the last few years in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, every October. Jim and I have been fortunate enough to be there, and this is, in my view, Kirk, the essence of that measurement summit these days. How do we know there are books about how to monitor the internet, books about how to measure the impact of social media and so forth. Katie Payne does a wonderful job of that. And in her book, she talks about turning the research into policy and into action. But the people who come to this measurement summit have had experience doing that, and they're wrestling with that last step, that the reason why we're paid our salaries, really, is to make a difference in what the organization ultimately does.
I think organizations need to have corporate blogs. They need to follow other blogs. They have to have somebody at a high enough level to know answers to questions, to be able to respond to those blogs. They're not just blogs that's being initiated by somebody in the corporation, but in which people can come in and raise concerns and ask questions and so on. There was just an article in PR Strategist a couple months ago on the Gulf oil spill. Perhaps you read it. Somebody named Gerald Barron, who's Executive Vice President of Communication at O'Brien's Response Management, wrote an article on BP's website and how it was used to answer questions and respond to issues and interact with people, bring in information, and so on. I've been told by a student this morning who worked with it that they didn't really follow up and use the information, so I really don't have a very strong opinion on how well BP actually responded to the crisis, but at least as it was described in that article, it seems to be a very good way of actually bringing information into a website and dealing with it. But I think we're just beginning to feel our way through this, but we have to think of how we can use the new media as a strategic tool and not just a messaging tool. And then if we go from there, if we use that as a principle, then we ought to be able to innovate. I don't think any of the excellence principles will ever precisely tell you how to organize a public relations department, for example. Some cases, it may work better to report to a marketing department. It just depends on who's the head of marketing. And other cases it may not. So it's, you know, you can take principle. What's important is to have a few relatively clear and simple principles that you can apply, and then most people are smart enough to figure out how to apply those principles in their own setting. And I think this is what's going to happen with social media.
Jim and Lori, it's always engaging. It's always enjoyable to interact with you. If you had a question you weren't able to ask, stop by the reception between 6 and 7 in the Fairchild Room, or just to stop by and say hi to Jim and Lori. But please join me in thanking Jim and Lori very much.
I have to laugh because my entire master's thesis was based on Christ's communication through your hearing.
No, Kenny, you're in Central Washington?
I am now. I was a professional for 8 years, and I have a master's in theater school.